Okay, so let's next. We're very honored this evening to have Dr. Henry A. Ferrara from the University of California, San Diego Department of Ophthalmology, the Shiley Eye Center. He is an assistant clinical professor with the university. I'm going to say a few comments about him, but like all our other presenters, we have vitas on them, and they're in the back of the program, so you can get more information about him and the others. But Dr. Ferrara has an extensive background in retinal disorders, and this evening he's going to be talking about many of them, but particularly diabetic retinopathy. Thank you. And he has, again, he has a very diverse clinical interest in retinal disorders and is a very active researcher. As busy as he is, he believes very strongly in giving back to the community. And one of what he is doing right now, he's a mentor to underrepresented students who are interested in pursuing medical careers. He may even talk about a little bit of this evening about the work he is doing and bringing these young people into the medical profession. So let's give him a hand and welcome.
I want to say thank you to the California Council of the Blind for the invitation. I'm truly honored to be here. Today what I'm primarily going to speak about is diabetic macular edema. And before we address this very important topic, I need to provide a little bit of background. Of course, many of the audience here probably knows a lot about it. The first thing I want to disclose is I have been a consultant for the company Thrombogenix, but it does not apply to today's talk. So diabetes, what is diabetes? Well, diabetes is a metabolic disorder. It is the inability of the body to process glucose from the bloodstream. There are two primary types of diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is due to a lack of the hormone insulin. The hormone insulin is what regulates the uptake or the removal of sugar from your bloodstream after you eat. More commonly, patients have type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is caused by the inability of the body to respond to insulin. So patients that have type 2 diabetes, they make insulin, but the body's not properly responding to insulin, so therefore sugar levels become very elevated. So why is diabetes a problem? It's a chronic disorder, and there is no cure for it, so it has to be managed. And with chronic hyperglycemia or chronic elevated blood sugar levels, there are complications such as kidney failure, neuropathy, which is damage to the peripheral nerves, and of course, diabetic retinopathy. How significant is it? Well, it's estimated there are approximately 25.8 million Americans that have diabetes. That's about 8.3% of the population. Currently, it's estimated that about 18.8 million are diagnosed, but there are about 7 million that are undiagnosed. Currently, diabetes is the leading cause of blindness among adults between 20 to 74 years of age. For adults above 70, it's macular degeneration. And in between 2005 and 2008, about 4.2 million patients with diabetes had diabetic retinopathy. What is diabetic retinopathy? Well, diabetic retinopathy is damage to the blood vessels caused by chronically elevated blood sugar levels. So the specific mechanism still remains to be elucidated, but it is thought that these chronic levels initiate damage to the capillaries, so the microvasculature, and the first signs is something called a microaneurysm, and that's significant for diabetic macular edema, which I'll discuss in a moment. Over time, there is damage to the small blood vessels that feed the retina. So the capillary bed gets destroyed. And with the loss of the capillary bed, there's ischemia. Ischemia simply means there's insufficient blood flow and oxygen, and portions of the retina are starving for oxygen. Over time, this initiates the development of abnormal blood vessels and scar tissue, which can lead to a retinal detachment. And this is called the stage known as proliferative diabetic retinopathy, which is when you have fibrovascular proliferation. So what is diabetic macular edema? So diabetic macular edema simply means that there is swelling, which is edema, of the macula. The macula is the central part of the retina. It's the portion of the retina that provides our central vision and our ability to see small objects. Why do patients get this? Well, there are two primary reasons. One are the microaneurysms. So microaneurysms are little dilations of the capillaries, and these little dilations are very leaky. So fluid leaks out, and it leaks into the retina, and the retina is like a sponge. So when the retina is dry, it's relatively thin and flat, but when the retina is wet, it swells just like a sponge. The other factor is related to a breakdown in what's called the blood-retina barrier. So just like the brain and the bloodstream have a blood-brain barrier, the retina, which is embryologically an extension of the central nervous system, also has an inner blood-retina barrier. This keeps the blood and the proteins within the blood from entering the retina. But with diabetes, the capillaries become very leaky. And so it's like having a leaky plumbing system. And over time, fluid leaks out. And when it leaks out into the retina will swell up just like, as I mentioned, sponge. And the other factor has to do with ischemia. So when the retina becomes ischemic, part of the pathological response is the production of a hormone known as vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF. So VEGF is the inappropriate response of the retina to ischemia. When the retina is not getting enough oxygen, it sends out this growth factor, which is normally involved in the development of blood vessels in an embryo or in wound healing. So when VEGF is made, it results in proliferation of blood vessels, but these are abnormal blood vessels. And it also has the other effect of causing increased leakage. So due to ischemia, the retina can become very leaky. So as you can imagine, and if you have a patient that has diabetes, if they have high blood pressure, if you have high blood pressure and a leaky system, it's going to increase the leakage. So the first thing about diabetes is, of course, long-term management of high sugar levels. It's been found in randomized prospective trials that tight sugar control can slow down the progression of diabetic retinopathy and also has been associated with decreasing the incidence of diabetic macular edema. If you add blood pressure control and triglyceride and cholesterol control, that also helps prevent diabetic macular edema. So how, as ophthalmologists, do we make this diagnosis? Well, it's very important for us to screen patients. That's because patients that have type 2 diabetes, about 50% of them, when they first get diagnosed, already have diabetic retinopathy. And that's because it usually goes undiagnosed for many years. When we do a screening exam, we dilate our patient's eyes, and that allows us to look at the retina very carefully. And we look for the clinical signs of retinopathy, hemorrhages, microaneurysms, something called cotton wool spots, which are little infarcts of the inner retina, and other signs like the more advanced stage is proliferative diabetic retinopathy. Fortunately, technology has also been highly prevalent in ophthalmology, and we have instruments which allow us to look at other findings in high detail. Fluorescein angiography is a way of analyzing the blood vessels in patients with diabetic retinopathy. It looks at the amount of leakage. So we can quantitate and also locate the areas that are leakage. That's particularly important, not just for diagnosis, but for guiding treatment. And perhaps the most significant advance has been the development of what's called optical coherence tomography, or OCT. OCT is a way of using a laser to produce a two- or three-dimensional image of the central retina with a resolution in commercial models of about 5 microns or 5 millionths of a meter. This allows us to look for changes such as the swelling. We can measure the amount of retinal swelling and look for fluid. So the fluid pockets that develop can also be detected with very good sensitivity. What's the treatment? Well, the gold standard for the last 50 years has been, as many of you probably already know, laser photocoagulation. The early treatment diabetic retinopathy study was a pivotal study that concluded that the loss of vision, or what we call moderate visual loss, was diminished by 50% using laser photocoagulation at a 3-year period. So the vision loss went from 24% down to 12%. Unfortunately, laser, of course, is not perfect. If you looked at the patients that underwent laser, only about 3% had an improvement in vision at 3 years. So many patients will still lose vision despite treatment. The treatment itself is less effective when the type of leakage is diffuse. So patients that have a diffuse form of macular edema didn't respond as well. And the laser has some risks. The scars that are left in the retina can result in small blind spots in someone's central vision. And in some cases, these can enlarge, leading to impairment. So laser still has a role in our current management of diabetic macular edema, but its effectiveness is probably limited more to patients that have swelling that is threatening the central vision, threatening the fovea, but is not quite involving the fovea yet. There have been some advances in laser treatment. There's something called micropulse diode laser. This uses very short bursts of laser energy. It's found to be effective in resolving diabetic macular edema in about 57% of patients at 6 months. And the curl damage is minimized because instead of applying laser over a tenth of a second, it's done at a 5% duty cycle, so it's a tenth of a millisecond over 200 milliseconds. Another treatment is called the Pascal laser. It allows us to apply patterns to treat the leakage, and that has made the treatment of diabetic macular edema easier for our practitioners. It's currently available. And there's a new system called the Navilas. It's a navigated laser system. It incorporates eye tracking and digital fundus photography to guide the treatment, so we can, on a computer screen, target exactly what we need to treat. And then also, if the patient moves, it will halt the treatment, and so it has an added layer of safety. Of course, when laser doesn't work, there have been some off-label treatments that have been effective. Intravitreal, which means injections into the eye of a steroid, are used off-label and shown to improve visual acuity by reducing edema, but they have significant side effects. About a third of patients develop elevated eye pressure, which is glaucoma, and it promotes the development of a cataract. In some patients, there are other factors which exacerbate the diabetic macular edema. For instance, if the internal membranes of the retina are very tight, or they have something called an epiretinal membrane that can exert traction on the retina, leading to increased leakage. And in those cases, or cases of refractory or unresponsive diabetic macular edema, vitrectomy, which is a type of surgery to remove these membranes, can be effective. Fortunately, in the last few years, there's been a paradigm shift. And there's a new paradigm in how we treat diabetic macular edema. And it has a lot of similarities in how we've learned to treat wet age-related macular degeneration. And this is really using what's called anti-VEGF therapy, or in other words, targeting that growth factor, vascular endothelial growth factor, which plays such a pivotal role in the development of diabetic macular edema as well as other eye problems. The first anti-VEGF drug that became available on the market is something called pegaptinib, or Macugen. This medication is an aptamer that binds to a specific form of VEGF called VEGF-165. It was initially approved to treat wet age-related macular degeneration, but it has been used off-label to treat diabetic macular edema. And in a phase 2 trial, they found that there was a lower percentage of patients needed a repeat laser. Unfortunately, pegaptinib does not work as well in practice because it binds to a region of this compound VEGF that is normally cleaved by proteins that are found in vivo. Another drug that has been in use for at least the last 5 years is something called Avastin or bevacizumab. This is once again an off-label use. Bevacizumab is approved for the use of metastatic colorectal cancer, but it's been in wide use for wet age-related macular degeneration, as well as diabetic macular edema. It's a monoclonal antibody, so it binds to all forms of VEGF-A, and by removing VEGF-A or VEGF from the eye, the effects, the leakage, decrease. In one recent result of a trial, the two-year results of the BOLT trial, which is the intravitreal bevacizumab or laser therapy trial, they found that the group that received Avastin or bevacizumab gained about 9 letters of vision, which is 2 lines of vision, versus the laser group that lost half a letter, which is about not a baseline, but no real change at 2 years. And 32% of the bevacizumab group gained at least 3 lines of vision versus only 4% in the laser group. So that's very encouraging. The downside with these injections is that their treatment is short-term. So unlike laser, which can lead to long-term benefit, these injections have to be repeated. So there are some drawbacks to injections. The most significant change has been the FDA approval of ranibizumab, which is Lucentis. This happened in August of this year. Lucentis was already approved for wet age-related macular degeneration, as well as a swelling from a retinal vein occlusion. Lucentis is very similar to Avastin. It's made by the same company, Genentech. It's a monoclonal antibody fragment that binds with high affinity and specificity to VEGF-A. And the pivotal trials were the phase 2 RISE and RIDE trials, which show that patients with ranibizumab were more likely to gain 3 lines of vision. It was about 40% versus 15%, and 16% had 20/40 vision or better. Another drug that just became approved earlier, it was approved in November of 2011, is something called aflibercept or Eylea. This is approved for wet age-related macular degeneration, recently got approved for macular edema from a vein occlusion. It's a fusion protein, so it contains the body of an antibody, but it contains the receptor, which binds with very high affinity to not only VEGF, but also something called placental growth factor, which is another growth factor involved in the process. So it's currently used off-label in the phase 2 da Vinci trial. Patients obtained better vision with aflibercept versus laser at 6 months, but it's still undergoing further evaluation. So what does this mean? Well, it does mean that with the advent of anti-VEGF therapy, patients that have edema that involves a central vision can respond. In many cases, it have an improvement in vision. In the past, they were the group of patients that responded least to laser. Whenever you laser, you're targeting energy to the retina and you're creating a burn. So if the swelling was involving the very center of the center of the fovea, you really couldn't laser that area because the laser itself would give a blind spot or hurt the vision. So you were limited in where you could laser. These anti-VEGF therapies allow us to treat central or foveal involving diabetic macular edema and likewise use the laser to supplement sources of leakage. So as a practitioner, we have many more options now in how we can treat edema. We can use injections to stabilize and improve the vision, and then we can use laser to try to create a more long-term effect. So the treatment of diabetic macular edema in the last probably 5 years is significantly evolving and changing. Laser had been the only real treatment for the last 50 years, and now it's really changing how we approach it. And our protocols are currently evolving. So there's still a lot of debate as to the best way to treat patients with DME. But it's encouraging to have these new therapies available. And that doesn't even address some of the other exciting developments in other fields like stem cells, which are being currently studied for geographic atrophy and dry age-related macular degeneration, as well as some of the genetic therapies being studied for hereditary disorders like RPE65. But I wanted to thank you once again for the invitation, and I'll leave the microphone open for questions.
Okay. If you have a question, please raise your hand, stand, so that the mic can be brought to you.
I have myopic macular degeneration in my left eye, and I've been the doctor has been giving me Avastin, and I was wondering, are there any studies that are going on now with Avastin?
Yeah, so there's a little bit of backstory to the use of Avastin. So prior to Avastin, the primary treatment for AMD was a type of laser known as photodynamic therapy. And unfortunately, what photodynamic therapy or PDT could do was slow down the rate of vision loss. But that was considered the best treatment we had. When Lucentis was being studied for wet AMD, the results were remarkable because even though patients were randomized and masked and they didn't know, in theory, what they were receiving, and neither did the practitioners, the practitioners figured out pretty early on who was getting the drug when their vision actually improved instead of lost. They didn't lose vision, which was unheard of with wet AMD. Meantime, Avastin, when given intravenously for colon cancer, was found to have the same effect, which makes sense when you understand the mechanism. They both work by binding to VEGF. So while Lucentis was being studied and undergoing FDA trials, Avastin was available. And in one of the early reports, the results were presented at retina meetings, and many practitioners began adopting it for patients who were failing the available treatment. And it responded so well that it became used widely. Recently, a CAT trial, which is the comparison of AMD treatment trial sponsored by the NIH, concluded that the two were comparable in efficacy and safety. So it kind of validated what people suspected. Because of its effectiveness in a number of related conditions like myopic choroidal neovascularization or myopic degeneration, which is what you described, what your diagnosis is, it also can be effective. And in fact, previously, PDT was considered the standard for myopic choroidal neovascularization. And there are some studies that have reported not only that Avastin is comparable, that it's actually better in terms of visual outcome compared to PDT. And unlike wet AMD that is usually chronic and requires ongoing treatment, most patients that have myopic choroidal neovascularization will respond to one, two, or maybe up to three injections. And once the abnormal membrane involutes, it doesn't recur with the frequency that you find in wet AMD. So Avastin is probably the one of the most commonly used treatments for myopic degeneration when there's choroidal neovascularization. Other drugs have not been studied widely because they are very costly. Lucentis, Eylea, are about $2,000 per dosage, and unless the pharmaceutical companies will sponsor that trial to extend the indications, it's very difficult to initiate a trial without a sponsor. Well, fortunately, and I've had to deal with this personally, unfortunately, some insurances will look at a treatment, and if it's not an FDA-approved trial indication, they'll say it's experimental. And fortunately, I've been able to, when that has come up, provide the literature, the evidence from studies, and in most cases, they will accept that and will pay for it. But there are exceptions. I've had some insurance companies that, despite the fact that it's the best treatment available, they'd rather not pay for it. Right. But off-label, as you have to remember, is a lot of medications are used off-label. So the FDA will approve a medication for a specific cause. So for instance, if you have an infection inside the eye, which is a very serious problem, there is no approved treatment for that. But there are effective off-label treatments that have been used for decades, which are intravitreal antibiotics. So for rare conditions, the process of getting FDA approval can be very lengthy and difficult. So there are treatments that are available, but they're used in an off-label basis.
In the mid-80s to 90s, I was treated with Cytoxan to control chronic inflammation and detachments. And as a result, I developed tumors in my bladder, which was a known drawback. Are the types of chemotherapy you mentioned earlier have that same consequence?
No, so that's a great question. And the Avastin, if you look at it as a chemotherapeutic agent, because it's used for metastatic colon cancer, it works by a completely different mechanism. When a tumor is growing, it needs new blood cells or blood vessels to feed the tumor. And so Avastin works by blocking the hormones that are involved in generating these new blood vessels. Cytoxin works by affecting the rapidly dividing cells. And I imagine that you probably had some type of uveitis or inflammation of... Okay, so you had VKH, Voigt-Koyanagi-Hirata's disease. Yeah, so in a chronic uveitis, you have to treat the underlying inflammation to prevent some of the blinding complications of the disease. And there are a number of different drugs that are used. All of them have significant potential side effects. One of the newer drugs that are being evaluated are called biologics. These are drugs which specifically target immune proteins like tumor necrosis factor alpha. You may have heard of some of these to treat autoimmune conditions. There's Humira, Enbrel, Remicade, and they've been particularly effective in controlling inflammation, but they do have potentials for increasing risk of cancer and increasing risk of infection. So patients that are on these medications do have to be closely monitored because of the seriousness of these side effects. So Avastin works by a different mechanism. That's not found to be a side effect of the Avastin.
Doctor, are you saying Avastin or Lucentis is the better treatment for macular degeneration?
For AMD? I'm saying that anti-VEGFs in general. So for wet age-related macular degeneration, in my professional opinion, Eylea, which is received approval last November, Lucentis, which was approved, I believe, in 2006, and Avastin, which has been used off-label since 2005, all have been found to have comparable efficacies, meaning when you look at their long-term vision, the results are similar. But there are differences between drugs, and in fact, my approach has always been if a patient is not responding to a particular medication after a set amount of injections, that you would consider switching to a different one, because there are subsets of patients who seem to respond better to one versus another. And it's been reported that patients may respond when you switch from one to the other. There's a phenomenon in which they become more resistant. It's called tachyphylaxis. So changing the medication can help. I'm not saying that I think an anti-VEGF is the best treatment for wet AMD. In my own experience and based on the literature, the first one that came out, which was Macugen, seems to be the least effective, but it still is better than the laser. And there are, of course, particular types of wet AMD in which the laser, either by itself or in combination with these injections, may be the best approach. And that's because wet AMD is not a single entity. There are a variety of different types. There's occult CNV and classic CNV and a mixed form. There's something called retinal angiomatous proliferation, something called polypoidal choroidal vasculopathy. So there are different types of wet AMD, and how they respond can vary. So you have to really tailor the treatment to the patient.
We have time for one more question, if there's one.
Don't see any hands.
Okay. Well, Dr. Farah, thank you very much this evening coming. Really appreciate it. To get some, we have a great deal of interest by our members, particularly those with diabetes, to know what are the newer treatments. And again, thank you very much for giving your evening to come to us.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we move on to legislative report, let's do a door prize. Get votes for that. Okay. Who's going to draw the... Okay. Yosemite Gateway has brought us a gobble bag of goodies. Okay, I'll draw, and then we'll do another one afterwards. Go ahead, Donna. Okay, and then you do the next one. I'm mixing them up.
Tom Traer.
Okay, I'm going to do one more right now, and Donna will pull this one. Silicon,
Big Top
Cupcakes?
Silicon Bakeware.
Oh, it's Bakeware. Sounds very good, and I think you'll draw my name on this. I know Kathy would like it.
Uh-oh. Should I draw your name, Gene?
Yes, of course.
Let's see. Is that the one that has the dot on it over there? The only one with the... Oh, I'm sorry. See? Transparency.
Yeah.
What's wrong with
it? Ethics.
Lillian Scaife.
Oh.
Okay, the other dot. Okay, here we go.
Bonnie Rainey.
Hey.
Good.